Welcome to Oncology Today, a special three-part edition on the role of HER2-directed therapy in the treatment of other HER2-expressing cancers beyond breast cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this edition of the program, I met with Dr. Kunwal Raghav from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. In addition to this interview, there's also a video recording featuring Dr. Raghav's full-length slide presentation. To begin, Dr. Raghav commented on his approach to side effect management for patients with colorectal cancer being treated with trastuzumab deruxtecan.
When these drugs were initially in colorectal cancer, there was no requirement in the trials for prophylactic antiemetics. And it was left up to investigator discretion. And I can tell you that at our center, we use prophylactic antiemetics all the time. You know, that is perhaps one of the reasons why the grade 3 adverse events of nausea and vomiting are actually minimal in these tumor types. So I do agree with you. I think you should be very aggressive with management of especially preventable side effects like nausea and vomiting, right? And with nausea and vomiting, you know, I'm a big proponent of starting primary prophylaxis, because once it has happened, then you're just, you know, you're creating a challenge for yourself to deal with later on. And most of these drugs are fairly well tolerated. So there is no reason why you should not be using antiemetic drugs for primary prophylaxis, frankly. In terms of ILD, again, there is a historical perspective, because breast cancer has been using HER2 ADCs, which have this ILD adverse event from day one, right? And they're very used to managing these side effects. But we've gotten better. The amount of, you know, side effects that we were seeing with TDXD in CRC-01 and CRC-02 studies were also very different. And I think partly it is because the investigators have gotten smart about recognizing these symptoms. We don't do CT scans every 8 weeks in general, but we should always keep a high degree of suspicion for these patients. So just to give you an example, you know, just last week in my clinic, we saw a patient who had had, I believe, only about two doses of this drug and had like very mild cough, you know, just nothing that's even bothering him. It just came up on like cross-questioning. And you know, on any other occasion, you would have like not paid attention to that cough, but we immediately got a CT scan and the patient did have some pneumonitis. So we started aggressively treating it. Now it's a very, it's a grade one kind of a pneumonitis. So, you know, we can re-challenge the patient with the treatment. But the whole, you know, couldn't agree with you more that the emphasis should be on early recognition of these side effects. And it would start with giving good patient education and then close follow-up of patients.
The patient you were talking about, what kind of cancer does the patient have?
Colon cancer.
And what age? They're on TDXD?
Yeah.
And incidentally, is the patient responding?
Well, it's only two doses, so we haven't like restaged
only two
the patient.
Doses.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, we haven't restaged the patient, but the tumor marker is already starting to go down. So I'm sure that the patient is responding, which makes it even more critical to identify those events earlier so you can treat them. That way, re-challenge is possible.
Yeah, except you said he had a cough.
Yeah, but it was like a really minimal cough. What I was trying to emphasize is on any other patient who was not on that drug, you know, I would have said symptomatic management of cough, right? We wouldn't have gone all the way. Like, I wouldn't have done this if the patient was on FOLFOX or FOLFIRI.
Right. And in terms of the issue of rechallenge, again, the breast cancer, you know, it takes a while for these algorithms to settle in. And then you start asking investigators, they all say exactly the same thing after a while. And one of the things that we hear from them, and not so consistently outside of breast, is if they have symptoms grade two or higher, they're not getting it again.
Agree yeah. So great. Yeah. I mean, I agree. I mean, I think it depends on a couple of factors. It depends on what are the options of treatment that the patient has. You know, this patient doesn't really have very good options of treatment. You know, for breast cancer, it could be different because you do have other options of therapy. So that's number one. Number two, it depends on like what is the degree of side effects. You know, grade 2 ILD or pneumonitis is defined as anything that's symptomatic. It interferes with your, you know, instrumental activities. It requires some medical intervention. So, you know, the way I look at it is, you know, a side effect of a mild cough, which was only brought forward because we are now in a habit of asking about cough, would not be considered, you know, a significant enough enough of a toxicity. Plus, you know, early institution of steroids and management of that earlier can be, and again, that does not mean that we are not going to, you know, keep a close eye on it going forward.
So another related question is, I'm curious whether you have ever used TDXD outside of a trial setting in a patient with colon cancer, and if you haven't, whether you would like to.
I personally have not used TDXD outside of a clinical trial, but I have had that luxury because we had both the trials open at MD Anderson initially. And we have another study now open at MD Anderson with a combination of this drug with ATR inhibitor, which is the NCI 10358 study. So we've been fortunate enough that we've had clinical trials. So we've been, you know, funneling patients towards those clinical trials, which I think is still the need, an unmet need in colorectal cancer. We haven't, you know, come to a point where we can, you know, start treating patients off protocol. But other patients, you know, other colleagues, and sometimes I've covered patients that are on TDXT because they have not been able to participate in that in clinical trials. You know, I was covering for one of my colleagues a few weeks ago, and I saw this patient for evaluation who has been on TDXT for 1.5 years now with good response. So,
with colon cancer?
With colon cancer. Again, like I said, very, you know, these, there's no doubt in my mind that these drugs are effective agents and they have changed the landscape of treatment in colorectal cancer.
You know, it's just sort of a commentary on where we are today in terms of using things and approving things. Like when we were doing this program with the bladder cancer, I was, you know, talking to one very, very prominent GU oncologist, and I'm saying, if you had a patient who was HER2 positive and they ran out of all approved options and they were in good health and, you know, they couldn't find a trial, would you give them TDXD? And, you know, the doc, she was like, well, you know, it was only 40 patients, you know, they only saw 10 responses or whatever, but the general medical oncologists who've used TDXT for the last 3 years are like, no, you don't understand. This is not like, you know, increasing PFS by 20%. You see the benefits. I've heard stories of people, you know, your man with a year and a half response. I've heard stories of people coming out of hospice. And I guess I wonder, you know, why we need a randomized trial exactly, but I guess that's just the way it is, huh?
Yeah, I think, you know, that I think these are very valid questions, but they also have a major value implication, right? So first of all, you know, in colorectal cancer, TDXD is now a part of NCCN guidelines, so it can be used. You know, and that's where NCCN has allowed access to patients, right? Again, Even with standard of care agents, clinical trials is always the preferred option. As long as, and I would always encourage that to anyone who can get their patients to a clinical trial, especially for these rare subsets, because, you know, the more improvement we can make in them is entirely based on like trial participation. But the reason for randomized trials, I think, is important because you still need to figure out effect sizes of these drugs. You also need to like have larger experience with those drugs because only then can you determine the value proposition of drugs, right? And also, sure, I think, you know, sure, the more patients treated on clinical trials, you know, we are good with doing biomarker-driven therapy, but it's not still precision therapy, right? Because one could ask the question, Dr. Love, why is it that if this is a targeted therapy, only 50% of patients are responding to it. Like, what about the other 50%? Why are they not responding, right? Or if somebody is responding, why is somebody responding for 12 months, whereas somebody is responding only for 6 months? These are all questions that are unanswered. And you know, I guess participation on clinical trials really does help hone that. But you should definitely have access to these drugs. I mean, I would not offer a patient TDXD with metastatic colorectal cancer in today's date and age.
Yeah, that seems to be what a lot of people are thinking. Now, you know, I'm not saying don't do the randomized trial, because like it seems like the NCI has a sort of, I mean, the FDA has a sort of staggered thing where they give a conditional approval and then they do a full approval. I just don't know why we're not, you know, they haven't done a sort of conditional approval, for example, of TDXD. You know, it seems, you know, people, it's NCCN obviously feels the same way. Anyhow, whatever. It's just, yep, just the thought. I'm sure a lot of people have those same feelings and maybe a little bit of frustrations. Let's take a look at your cases.
So, you know, let's, you know, these cases are a classic example of, you know, how this biomarker has really impacted patients, right? So, and I first discussed this first case, and this is very near and dear to my heart because it was the first HER2 patient that I diagnosed in my clinical practice. So, 57-year-old lady presented with this synchronous metastatic rectosigmoid adenocarcinoma with lung metastases. Back in 2013, she received first-line chemotherapy with bevacizumab and FOLFOX, very appropriate at that time, and received this for 9 months, had some initial response, but then had disease progression. And overall, she tolerated the treatment well, but by the end of 9 months, she started having this grade 2 neuropathy in hands and feet, which she actually has persistent neuropathy to date. And then, you know, we tested her for HER2, and she had a HER2 positive status. This was December 2013. And then she was enrolled on a trial of trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And I'd like to show you some of these pictures later on, just to show you, you know, the incredible responses to this. But the bottom line is that the patient achieved a PR with his secondary staging and retained this PR for nearly 3.5 years. Every 3 weeks. I mean, this is a regime that you get every 3 weeks. And she tolerated this regime, cruised through it for 3.5 years with PR, and finally had, of course, you know, progressive disease. There were no grade greater than two, greater than two grade adverse events. And then the therapy, you know, patient progressed, therapy was changed to anti-EGFR and FOLFIRI. We already discussed how, you know, anti-EGFR drugs may not be as effective in this population, but we didn't have any other options at that time. So we treated her with anti-EGFR and FOLFIRI. She received about 3 months of this treatment, had a horrible time, severe rash, you know, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, diarrhea, GI toxicities as expected from irinotecan. And yet, unfortunately, she progressed, which was life-changing for her, knowing that for 3.5 years, she had tolerated a treatment with no, you know, with very limited adverse events. And then she entered another clinical trial, this time with zanidatamab, was on it for 6 months, had stable disease, and then, you know, tolerated it well, had some diarrhea, but good tolerance otherwise, and then progressive disease. And then the patient was enrolled on trastuzumab deruxtecan trial. So this is the third trial in August 2018, and had a partial response and stayed on that trial for nearly a year and a half before finally progressing. And again, tolerated this treatment very well. So, you know, these are some of the scans that we, very representative scans, but you can see dual anti-HER2 therapy. This is, you know, a good response. So 2013 to 2018, 17. And then this is the bottom two curves are a response on the antibody drug conjugates. And you can see these are real responses. These are not like small responses. So from 2013 all the way to 2020, 7 years, three different trials, you know, a tremendous, tremendous story and very inspiring patient.
Before you go into the next stage, so I'm just kind of curious about the possibility of, you know, anti-HER strategies in earlier stage disease, because certainly gastrointestinal cancer, you know, breast cancer, obviously, even lung cancer, you're seeing first-line anti-HER therapy. Are there trials going on right now in the neoadjuvant, adjuvant, and first-line metastatic setting of HER2 strategies in colon cancer?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very logical progression of how we should, where we should take this. There is a first-line metastatic cancer trial, which is the Mountaineer 3 trial. This is a trial of trastuzumab to tucatinib combined with chemo versus the standard of care, which would be chemo plus a biological agent. This is a first-line trial. You know, for trastuzumab deruxtecan, there is no currently no trials currently running in first or second line, but would be the, you know, logical next steps. With regards to adjuvant trials, so far I'm not aware of any adjuvant or neoadjuvant trials in this setting, partly because it's still a low prevalence biomarker. But I think that that's a very interesting and thought-provoking idea.
A lot of research done on MSI-high, and that's pretty unusual too.
Yeah, that's true. That is right. Absolutely.
I think it's common. One other thing I was going to ask you as you're giving your talk, any thoughts about disatamab vedotin? You know, we hear about that in bladder cancer. Is that going out beyond that?
Yeah, so, you know, there are multiple ADCs that are on the brink of you know, development in various tumor types. I think apart from the target, one of the other things that's sort of key is like the payload. You know, and the payload of you know, microtubule inhibitors appears to be less effective in GI tumors or colorectal cancer as topoisomerase 1 inhibitors. So again, it's a developing field. So hopefully we can overcome that relative resistance by providing a big or good drug antibody ratio, but not aware of any data that suggests great activity so far with those class of compounds. Now, there are multiple clinical trials ongoing with antibody drug conjugates in colorectal cancer with other targets, just apart from HER2. So stay tuned.
So that was a great case. Let's take a look at your other case.
Yeah. So this patient is a 60-year-old, diagnosed with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, liver and lung metastases back in 2016, received first-line chemotherapy with gemcitabine cisplatin, as would be the standard of care at that time, and received this treatment for about 6 months, had initial response, which was, you know, only short-lasting, but then had disease progression within 6 months, and did have some moderate nausea and vomiting with cisplatin and gemcitabine. Second-line treatment, FOLFOX, you know, treated for 3 months and straight away progressed through that. And then in October 2017, she was enrolled on a trial with zanidatamab and achieved a partial response. This response was actually sustained for about, you know, 8 months or so. When she did develop progressive disease. Now, this is, you know, overall, she tolerated this treatment well and actually had some grade 2 diarrhea in most cases. But because she was on a protocol, I think, you know, she did have some interruptions, regular interruptions in the protocol therapy because of the hypokalemia that was associated with the diarrhea, which we found it a little hard to correct. So, you know, even though a limited response, but still a good response. And you know, this is also a classic example of sometimes how toxicities can limit your therapeutic window. So this is her scan. You can see again, these are real responses. You can see that the liver lesion responded very well. The lung lesions were, also had some response, but not as robust. So there could be some tissue differences in those responses. It's hard to know. But again, an example, or two classic examples, two different diseases of patients participating on clinical trials and contributing to the wealth of literature, which everybody else can benefit from. So I think very inspiring cases.
I think so, too. I want to finish out, first of all, getting your thoughts about where this is heading, other new strategies that may be interesting or are being looked at right now, but also to talk a little bit more about some of the translational issues. As I mentioned, I read a couple of your papers I thought were really interesting and I wanted to ask you more about from that point of view. One, you did this sort of editorial of the pressing need of precision care in HER2-positive colorectal cancer, the elephant in the room, that paper, and then the graphic that you all put together with the elephant on it, which is really cool. I just want you to explain it. Most of our audience is listening. They're out, shoveling snow or running or whatever. And plus, a lot of people like me, we don't get these diagrams, so we want you to explain it. The other paper I really love was this Molecular Pathways and Mechanism of HER2 in Cancer Therapy. This is from Clinical Cancer Research. And again, really cool graphic. But, this whole thing with the dimerization and how pertuzumab works and, how ADCs fit in. How do you sit down with your fellows or you're walking down the hall and just explain to them sort of your vision of how that HER2 axis works and the various different interventions we've developed to target that axis?
The basic way in which we see HER2 is that we know that this is definitely a biomarker in multiple diseases, right? I'm going to talk about mostly colorectal cancer, but there is enough data which suggests that it's a real biomarker, right? So the part ahead of us is to take this biomarker-directed therapeutic strategy and convert it into precision medicine, right? And precision medicine means we can do personalized treatment. So just to give you an example, I had a patient who was on my pathway trial and high gene copy numbers, high expression, 3+ gene copy numbers were also pretty good. And, I'm talking to this patient and I'm telling them about how dual anti-HER2 therapy, I think, is really good for you. But notice that on their tumor type, they had a concurrent PIK3CA mutation, right? So when you look at the biomarker analysis of a bi-pathway study, you find that when you have a PIK3CA mutation, your responses tend to be less than what they are for a PIK3CA wild type. Now, that's not really, it's not, one case does not evidence make. But it's very interesting to understand how the pressing analysis also highlighted this fact that when you look at HER2 strategies, there are two broad strategies. The first strategy is you are depending on the fact that a tumor is dependent or addicted to the HER2 pathway. And that's where you have to shut that pathway down, right? And that dependent on the pathway depends on how high your amplification is, because the higher the amplification, the more your tumor is dependent on it, right? Do you have any concurrent mutations? Like, is there a HER2 mutation there, or is there a KRAS mutation there? And if you don't have all of these and you have a highly dependent tumor, then you would have responses, right? So we looked at this in the SWOG 1613 study, which was a randomized trial of trastuzumab, pertuzumab compared to cetuximab and irinotecan, right? And what we found is that when you have high gene copy numbers, you respond very well to anti-HER2 therapies, and you don't respond well to anti-EGFR therapy. and vice versa. When you have low gene copy numbers, then you don't respond to anti-HER2 therapies because you don't have a highly HER2-addicted tumors, and you actually respond to anti-EGFR therapy, right? So that's where one has to keep in mind that this is a, it's a complex disease. It's not a binary outcome, right? And the second strategy is these antibody drug conjugates. Now, this strategy does not really depend on your addiction. And that is the reason why even prior HER2-treated population responds, right? Because you treated them with anti-HER2 therapy, you shut down their pathway, they develop some resistance mechanism, but they still have HER2. And now you give them antibody drug conjugates and they still respond because you still have that marker. And that's where you use this as a homing beacon. However, just like chemotherapy, patients will develop resistance to it. Now, the reason why it's necessary to understand this paradigm is because if you now want to develop strategies that can either expand the value of antibody drug conjugates in colorectal cancer, then you need to combine them with agents that can increase the sensitivity to that chemo payload, or you change the receptor dynamics such that you can make more and more drug delivered inside the cells. And that's where I think the future of antibody drug conjugates and lies, right? So I think, you know, the emphasis on the elephant was that it is a, it's a more complex story than what you would see only from one vantage point. You have to see this from multiple vantage points. And the similar emphasis is on the other CCR manuscript, which emphasizes that there are so many different factors that affect this, that there is no one key mechanism of combating this disease. So I think this is why it needs collaborations, it needs translational research, and it needs clinical trials at the end of the day.
You know, believe it or not, yesterday I was doing the same kind of program as we're doing right now with a breast cancer investigator from Mass General. And he put up this graphic of, in terms of endocrine, you know, the ER, you know, so much going on now with estrogen, you know, targeting estrogen late stage disease. And I was looking at it and I started to have that same thought you just verbalized, which is that it's not a binary. It's like all these things interacting. It kind of made me think a little bit about AI.
Yep.
You know, there's some pattern that we're not seeing that's there. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's where I think big data would be very helpful, right? Is if only you could gather all the evidence that we had for every HER2-treated patient, we would be so much smarter, right? Instead of relying on what, 200, 300 patients that have been treated on known clinical and published clinical trials.
Another thing I want to ask you about this idea and that paper, the pressing paper, that kind of really kind of gets into the elephant thing and all, is like, where do the TKIs like tucatinib fit in? And actually, neratinib is another TKI, at least in breast cancer, targets HER2, because they have, I think they have activity against mutations, but also, I guess, against the pathway?
I mean, you know, that's one of the things that we have to see is like, if you have HER2 mutations, the pressing data mostly was composed of agents that were, you know, some were, you know, TKI, but it wasn't like tucatinib treated population. And they found that HER2 mutations don't, you know, respond as well. Those with concomitant HER2 mutations don't respond. Now, is it that they don't respond because the mutations are just more, you know, potent such that, you know, inhibiting the signal up the receptor doesn't really affect because you're constitutionally active, right? And can tucatinib or a small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor overcome that? I think we don't know that for sure, but it's a very valid hypothesis that needs to be tested. And that's where, you know, the value of using, you know, dual, say, trastuzumab pertuzumab, which is a dual monoclonal antibody kind of strategy versus trastuzumab tucatinib, which is monoclonal antibody with a small molecule tyrosine kinase, or an ADC strategy, right? Like if dual HER2 inhibition is not going to work very well, Like, are these the patients that should be first challenged with ADCs, right? How do we sequence these drugs? So I think, you know, that's where most of our research is centered towards, you know, figuring out.
Want to take a shot at talking about HER3, patritumab, et cetera, where that fits in?
Yeah, so, you know, HER3 has shown some benefit in, you know, breast cancer. There's some increasing data in lung cancer. We know that by itself, this molecule is not a molecule that causes oncogenic addiction, right? Because we have multiple trials that have shown that just inhibiting HER3 has not really made any dent. But the antibody drug conjugates, again, are changing that pattern, right? And it's not just true for HER3, it's true for multiple other agents like MET and CCAM and TROP2. I mean, these have no known oncogenic addiction value, but the antibody drug conjugates are still working, which is why I think HER3 is a major target, because it is more ubiquitously expressed than HER2. But you know, whenever we talk about any targets, I think we have to be cautious. Because just the prevalence of the target is not a sufficient criteria. I think the target dynamics of how it interacts with anything that binds to it, what are the internalization dynamics, how quickly cycling can take place, whether it will even be able to effectively deliver something appropriately. I mean, all of these things are very important to study, and I hope that, you know, as time passes, there'll be more emphasis on understanding those targets than just, you know, throwing drugs unselected at patients.
I'm starting to think of targets like addresses, you know, that you can deliver to. Another thing another thing that you mentioned, you used a couple of words that I was just curious how you would define, because you said it in an interesting way. The term biomarker and the term precision medicine or precision oncology.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I sort of like, you know, figuring out a sports analogy. It's like, you know, you have to hit a target, right? So the first thing is you have to face the target, right? I mean, there's no point of like trying to hit a target with a, say, bow and arrow or a gun or whatever it is, if you face in the other direction. So now at least we know, okay, which direction we have to face in. We know where the target is. But whether you have to measure, you know, the airspeed and like how far the target is, how much, you know, gravity plays into, I mean, all of those things are precision, right? Precision medicine is all about bringing whatever therapeutic strategy you have to as select a patient population as possible, right? You know, ideally, a precision personalized therapy would be, I can figure out who is the patient who would benefit from this drug versus another drug, right? And you know, those response rates should be really, really high. I mean, it depends. You could ask, you know, multiple oncologists and they would differ in that strategy. But like, I look at example of lung cancer and breast cancer, where, you know, EGFR mutant lung cancer has a response rate of close to 70-80%, right? Whereas anti-EGFR therapies in colorectal cancer, even with combined with chemotherapy, have response rates of 30-40%, right? So I think these are biomarker strategies, but in colorectal cancer, we haven't yet reached that precision level. And precision level means not just take all BRAF mutant patients and treat them with BRAF therapy, but figure out the 25% patients that would respond to that therapy. And for the others, try to figure out other rational means, right? I think that's where we need to take HER2.
So I'm also curious whether or not in terms of ADCs, one doc mentioned to me, an investigator, that there some ADCs have as their payload, like an immune payload. So, like, what other kinds of payloads are there besides chemo out there? I don't know if there are a target, you know, more targeted payloads or different kinds? I mean, I was surprised about this immune thing, but it seems like a logical idea. You have the target to, you know, get to the cancer cells that maybe more than chemo would work. Particularly immune sounds interesting. Anything happening there?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the ADCs are just the surface, right? They're just the archetype of where you can target the surface characteristics of a tumor, right? The surfaceome, so to say, right? You know, because chemotherapy has been our oldest friend in colorectal cancer, that's why obviously antibody drug conjugates becomes, you know, the key thing. But the payload can be anything. You know, one of the developing fields is radio conjugates, so radiation,
right,
in a targeted fashion. The other thing is things like T-cell engagers. So I would consider that a sort of surface targeted strategy, right? Where you take a surface target and you try to engage T cells based on that surface target. And that's where, you know, immune conjugates come into the picture. You know, there can be toxins that are, you know, not cytotoxics, but other form of toxins, like bacterial toxins, right? So I think that there are many strategies of conjugating drugs. They all essentially still depend on the target. They still depend on, like, the characteristics of the target. You could cycle through these strategies, right? You could imagine a point where you went through dual anti-HER2 inhibition. This is aspirational, but I hope we get there at some point of time. Dual anti-HER2 inhibition, antibody drug conjugate, a radio conjugate, and possibly an immunoconjugate, you know. And these are different strategies. So hopefully the aim here is to, you know, provide our patients the maximum clinical benefit.
Subsequent to this recording, on April 5th, 2024, the U.S. FDA, for the first time, approved a therapy, T-DXd, that is now the first HER2-directed therapy to receive a tumor-agnostic approval in patients with previously treated advanced HER2-positive solid tumors. This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Raghav, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.